This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 11th of September. The Prime Minister says the Conservatives broke the NHS. If he's right, how will Labour fix it? A report is due to advise them on the shape of their reform plans. But when money is so tight, what can realistically be achieved? David Lammy and Anthony Blinken have been in Ukraine, hearing a plea from President Zelensky for a loosening of the restrictions on the use of long-range missiles supplied by Western allies. And English Heritage say as many as 50 commemorative blue plaques on buildings in London remembering famous former residents have gone missing, and they want help to find them. How will the new Labour government fulfil its election pledge to transform the National Health Service? This is what the party told voters in its manifesto, and I quote, "Our mission is to build an NHS fit for the future. Investment alone won't be enough. It must go hand in hand with fundamental reform." Well, the party is about to have sight of a report it commissioned the moment it won the election, a report which, we're told, will shape its thinking on health policy. Lord Darzi, a surgeon and former health minister under Gordon Brown, has compiled it. And we know from remarks made by the Prime Minister over the weekend that it's going to be highly critical of the last Conservative government. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, Sir Keir Starmer said the Conservatives broke the NHS.
I don't think anybody watching this is going to be surprised by his conclusion. Everybody watching this who has used the NHS, or relatives have, know that it's broken. They know that it's broken. That is unforgivable, the state of our NHS. If there's one thing this country knows, it's the last government broke the NHS. Our job now, through Lord Darzi, is properly understand how that came about and bring about the reforms.
Well, with me is our health editor, Hugh Pym. Hugh, a bit of background to the report and how it came about, first of all.
Well, Julian, within hours of taking office, Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, back in July, came out with this statement, "The NHS is broken," which was pretty surprising at the time, a pretty bleak assessment of what he was inheriting. Then came stories about the Care Quality Commission being not fit for purpose and a review there showing that needed a lot of attention to get that right. And then Lord Darzi, the eminent surgeon, a former Labour health minister, but now an independent peer, he was asked to do a rapid review of the assessment, assessing the NHS. And that's what is about to be published. And the government's had for a week or so, bits of it have been leaked out. The suggestion that the NHS really is in a very poor state. And Lord Darzi was shocked by what he found, examples being that 100,000 infants waited 6 hours in A&E last year in England. The report is about England. 175,000 children and young people were waiting 6 to 12 months for hospital treatment, that cancer outcomes were getting worse, higher cancer mortality rates than other countries. Productivity was not what it should be. Waiting times had swelled. Too big a share of the budget was being spent in hospitals, not enough in community care. So this sets the scene for Sir Keir Starmer giving his response tomorrow. And we understand details of how they're going to come up with a 10-year plan for the NHS will be set out. And I think quite a lot of questions will focus on what the government wants to do in the way of reform, having now established that it's in a pretty poor state. And they, of course, are blaming the inheritance from the Conservatives.
What it wants to do and whether it can afford to do it.
Yeah, I think money will be an important part of it. What we understand Lord Darzi will say is that money is certainly not the only answer. There does need to be a serious look at the way the NHS goes about its activities. But money will be needed, for example, on new hospital buildings and new equipment. and some sort of investment will be required to generate the sort of reforms that are being talked about. And of course, finances are very stretched at the moment. Wes Streeting, in an event at the think tank the Health Foundation this evening, has said that there are trade-offs and that any extra money for the NHS will mean less money elsewhere. So it doesn't seem as if short-term money is going to be much there, and this 10-year plan is going to be a long-term aspiration. So the months ahead and the winter and the immediate performance of the NHS will continue as it is now, one assumes.
Hugh, thank you very much for that. Well, one of the issues the report is expected to highlight is increasing waiting times. Here are two examples from people who contacted the BBC over the frustrations the NHS has caused them. Paul Rogers started getting issues with his back in March last year. He's been telling me what happened since.
Well, my journey started back in March of last year. I had pains in my lower back and legs. I couldn't get a doctor's appointment for a few weeks. One thing has led to another. I ended up in A&E, which I was then passed from pillar to post. And since September of last year, I've been going in and out of hospital. My experience of being in A&E was probably the equivalent of a field army hospital, where they're just literally patching people up and sending them on the way. Gradually, as the months went on, the pain was getting worse and worse and worse. Then I phoned 111, explained to them that I got chronic back pain and I was having problems controlling my bowels. It's taken up until now, after technically since March of last year, for treatment.
And Kieran Ash's daughter has had to wait for over 18 months to have her tonsils removed.
It was very stressful, very scary. It wasn't just a case of the hospital. It's waiting for 18 months with a six-year-old girl who's getting more and more and more poorly. Me and my wife, we did feel kind of helpless, to be honest with you. It got to a point where the doctor had prescribed her with antibiotics permanently. She was taking them every week until an operation, but they had stopped working. So even being on antibiotics, she's still getting tonsillitis. And in the build-up to that, it was even more frustrating, to be honest with you, because we'd eventually get a doctor's appointment, see a doctor, and they'd tell us we need this medicine or that medicine, and send us to a pharmacy. We would arrive at a pharmacy and be told that that medicine's not available, and we'd have to literally stand there ringing whatever pharmacy we could find whilst we stood there in a queue or, you know, at a counter trying to find the right one. Someone's got the right medicine we can't even say the names of. We don't understand why the onus was on us to do all of that.
What does all that say to you about the system and the way it works, or for you perhaps doesn't work?
It's failed. It's broken, completely failed. And when we look back at it, we kind of realise that what did happen and how Poppy was dealt with, it wasn't fair. What infuriated us is there's no one to turn around to and go, look, this isn't acceptable, what's going on? And just to be told, you know, she's on a waiting list, they can't tell us how long that's going to be. I understand that there is pressure. I get that. And especially with ear, nose and throat straight after the pandemic, I get that everyone's playing catch up. I think what hurt more than anything is that phone call that day to the doctor's surgery, and it was made to feel as if we're wasting their time. We felt quite failed, to be honest with you. As a parent, it breaks you.
Well, listening to that, and with me in the studio is Lord Bethell. He was Health Minister during the last Conservative government from 2020 to 2021. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Julian.
Sir Keir Starmer told Laura Koonsberg the Tories broke the NHS in a way that was, quote, unforgivable. What do you say?
Well, the Darzai Review is a very powerful document. He definitely describes in accurate and clear details many of the troubles that are facing the NHS today. And I don't think anyone reading it would argue with any of the evidence that he's put forward. But politicising this at a time when all healthcare systems are under a huge amount of pressure, when demographic pressures, when problems with supply chains, as described by Poppy's dad there, when a whole host of huge pressures on our health systems are giving everyone a pain, to simply pile into the Tories like that, I'm not sure is very helpful.
Why is this politicising it if you can add all the figures and all the statistics that we have just heard a flavour of under the Conservative government?
Well, Lord Darzai spells it out very clearly in the bill, in his report. He describes why healthcare systems are under pressure today because of our ageing population, because of the workforce pressures that we're all feeling, because of the sophistication of the medicines, which mean that procedures are much more complicated, and because of our increasingly unwell population, because the determinants of health, the housing, the food environment, and all of these things have become so difficult to be healthy in. That's what's driving the boom in sickness. And there are other problems.
But he specifically points to English issues and spending in England issues, doesn't he? Almost £40 billion less spent in England than peer countries on health assets and infrastructure since the 2010s. In other words, since the Conservatives came to power.
Yes, he does. That's absolutely right.
Why did that happen?
Right. So he points out correctly that in the UK we're spending $5,500 compared to a European average of $5,800. So on a run rate, we're spending a comparable amount to the rest of Europe. But from a capital point of view, you're right. We have got a deficit of $39 billion.
So over a significant period of time, a government in power knows that it's not spending enough on health, sees the figures that we've just heard reference to, and still doesn't act on it.
Well, there was action and there are lots of plans, maybe not enough. I think a question that Lord Darzay, we should answer, and I'd love to hear his answer, he's a very thoughtful guy, is why does he think that money wasn't spent? Does he think it was some kind of conspiracy to wreck the NHS? I don't think it was. It has been impossible to persuade the Treasury that we will get a return on investment by investing in NHS capital for a very long time. They don't believe that the economic return of investing in our population health is going to be good for the economy. And I think that is the fundamental problem that lies behind it. And I wish Wes Streeting well when he goes and has the conversation about where to find the missing $39 billion.
But do you accept that the Conservatives let the country down in this area? You only have to look at the public satisfaction figures. In 2010, 70% were satisfied. In 2023, 24%. Were satisfied. And you just heard those two examples. You were taking notes as you heard them. Those are the people affected by this.
Yeah, I mean, those two anecdotes ring a bell with me. They are absolutely classic problems. What on earth was Paul doing going to A&E to have a back problem sorted out? He should have been dealt with by community health support and be treated at home. And poor old Poppy, you know, getting AMR for waiting so long, that is a chronic problem. Yes, I am unbelievably frustrated that the NHS, which can be so brilliant a lot of the time, is so bad too much of the time.
We must leave it there. Lord Bethell, thank you very much indeed for coming in, listening to that. Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the NHS Confederation, which speaks for the healthcare system as a whole in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. He also led the Number 10 policy unit under Tony Blair, as well as a government review on workers' rights for Theresa May. Matthew Taylor, good evening.
Hi.
How important is it from your point of view to have a diagnosis along the lines that we've just been discussing before you start thinking of a solution?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard the Darzi review referred to as the first chapter of the 10-year plan that Labour has promised next year. And I think in one way, that's a very effective way of thinking about this. We need to understand where we are. We need to understand why we're here. And I think this report identifies the problems with access, with quality, with outcomes, and it provides a pretty convincing account of why it is that we got here, which is really the kind of combination of austerity, the NHS reforms, which led to a loss of managerial and other capacity, and then COVID comes on top of that. And COVID affected us more than many other similar health systems. But that's kind of analogy of, well, it's the first chapter of the strategy. I guess the question is, we've written the first chapter, but we really don't have much idea of what the rest of the plot of this is going to be. And we won't until next spring.
Especially if there is not much money around, which we know there isn't because of everything that's been said over the last 2 months.
Well, yes. And I don't think Lord Darzi hides the fact that money is implicated in this, partly revenue. Those years of austerity when we got less than half the increase every year that health economists say health systems need, but mainly, as Lord Bethell confirmed, capital investment, where we're way behind. And that's one of the reasons we're not very productive, because we don't have that investment in buildings and equipment.
Well, let me just pick you up on that, if I can, for a moment. What should happen about that capital investment? When Lord Bethell was critical of the Treasury, have you had any assurances from the Treasury, for example, that the attitudes to capital investment will change under this government?
So I think there are two arguments that we need to win with the Treasury, and I suspect the Department of Health is trying to win those. The first is that the really big challenge for the economy is the long-term demand curve for health, which is driven by population aging, rising expectations, new treatments. Now, if you project that curve forward, we'll see more and more money spent on health, a bigger and bigger proportion of public spending, a bigger proportion of national wealth. And that is unsustainable. We have to bend that demand curve. But the only way to bend that demand curve is to do things radically differently. And to do things radically differently when you've got a system that is already at full capacity means, first of all, you have to invest more in capital. But second, you have to do what people call double running. You've got to run this system, and alongside it, you've got to try to build a new system. And that is not cheap to do.
And do you sense any willingness from the Treasury to acknowledge that and act on it?
Well, I think critical to this is saying that health is not just a black hole into which you pour money, but an investable proposition. And one element of this which gives me some hope is the growing focus on the 2.8 million people out of the workforce, not paying taxes, claiming benefits, not available for work as a result of health and care issues, many of those people on waiting lists. So I think one of the arguments people are mobilising with the Treasury is, if we could invest more in health and care and help get some of those people back to work or stop people leaving work for health and care related reasons, then that's tax revenue, it's less benefit spending, it's more people ready to work. So we've got to change the argument about health and demonstrate that it is an investable proposition. And I get the sense that this is an argument Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting are making to the Treasury.
Right. When do you think waiting list times will start to come down?
Oh, I'd be very, I mean, they're pretty much plateauing at the moment. They normally get longer during winter because, of course, we're facing pressures, particularly at the front door, the emergency department. I would be surprised to see any significant movement before next spring or summer. And then it will be slow, and it will take at least a full term for Labour to get anywhere near the kinds of targets they've got for waiting lists.
Matthew Taylor, we're grateful to you. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. Coming up later on The World Tonight, I've been to visit the former home of the pioneering surgeon Joseph Lister in search of a missing blue plaque.
The story is that he had one before, but it's disappeared twice, and the second time we think it's gone for good.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to the States. The US presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have attended a memorial in New York on the 23rd anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. It was a much more somber affair after last night's head-to-head television debate ahead of the election in November. Both sides on that have claimed victory after that 90-minute debate, which was watched by more than 57 million people. Now, many US states are now either so strongly Democrat or so strongly Republican that there are now only a handful of places that could go either way, and they're where this election will be decided. The state of Michigan is one of them, and our reporter John Sudworth has been there to find out how voters have been reacting to last night's debate.
Outside a job centre here in downtown Saginaw, I meet Monica.
Good morning, I'm from England.
She's looking for work as a dietitian.
Just as we pulled in, it reminded me that Saginaw is mentioned in that Paul Simon song.
It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We've all gone to look for America.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we're doing here.
Yep, yep, okay.
Middle class, hardworking, and in this until recently bluest of blue Democrat states, Monica fits the profile of what you might expect.
Democratic.
That's a dead cert?
Yep.
Kamala Harris?
Yep.
Do you have friends who are leaning Trump?
Yeah, actually my son is for Trump.
Do you try to understand what the substance is behind the people who find Trump. Donald Trump's message attractive?
Not really.
But it's a thought that does need entertaining. Donald Trump narrowly won Michigan in 2016. The Democrats took it back in 2020. And it is yet again on a knife edge.
Yeah. I'm about to do a resume.
Wes and Maz are two young black men also at the job centre looking for work.
We downtown, but we still in the gutter, I ain't gonna lie.
And what do you do for a living?
I make money. I'm a businessman. I'm a street entrepreneur.
Who are you voting for?
I'm voting for Trump because I was the richest I ever was when Trump was in office.
Okay. Do you worry that when you hear those criticisms of people who say that at heart Trump is a racist?
My grandma thinks stuff like that because when I tell her I'm voting for Trump, she say, boy, what? But that's grandma. I understand. Grandma, you vote for who you want to vote for. I'm going to vote for the president that's in my best interest.
With so much of this country now either deeply Republican or deeply Democrat, where the outcomes are such foregone conclusions, Michigan is one of the few swing states that will decide this election, and Saginaw is one of the few swing counties in it.
Okay, what have you got yourself there for breakfast?
Just a donut and some coffee.
Sounds perfect. Do you know how you're going to vote November the 5th?
To be honest, not really. I mean, I'm not happy with either one of the candidates.
And that makes Chuck one of the few swing voters with the future of America in his hands.
You're the magic undecided voter that everybody's chasing.
A part-time police officer who runs his own real estate business. Before the debate, he told me the decline of Michigan's car industry has left Saginaw with real problems.
Back then, everybody had money and jobs were readily available, and you see the change and people are struggling.
So, what did he make of what he heard? After the debate, I gave him a call.
I mean, my big takeaway is I do believe Kamala was the shining star on that. I believe she won. I felt like she was a little more presidential acting. The bottom line is she's won my vote.
But debates are fleeting. It is the economy that matters in American elections. And in the hard, grimy work of a truck polishing business, speaking to the workers, you get a sense of a deeper sentiment that Trump is tapping into. Jeremy Zender runs this company, surrounded by the giant articulated lorries, the lifeblood of America's economy. He explains the shifting allegiances that are making this election in a state once certain Democrat territory now so close.
With the truckers, they're all leaning towards the right.
Everyone?
I don't know of one that isn't.
Kathleen Skelsey is knocking on Saginaw's doors for Kamala Harris, battling for every vote, sometimes quite literally.
That's a joke.
Okay, well, so this
Harris
is the guy
joke.
That, you know, I ran into earlier, so.
Vote for Trump. Harris is a joke. She's a clown.
Being heckled by Trump voters, she sees little rationale behind their politics.
That's what's scary, is trying to understand where these people, you know, they're thinking. And I just think that they don't understand, or they're not educated, or fell asleep in school or something.
Michigan is as close as it gets. But debates need common ground, and there's very little of that left.
John Sudworth reporting from Michigan. Well, there was a reminder in Kyiv today that diplomacy in the midst of a war can be interrupted. That air raid siren sounded as the Foreign Secretary David Lammy, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and President Volodymyr Zelensky were meeting to discuss further Western support for Ukraine, support which the Ukrainians would like to include permission to use long-range missiles supplied by its allies against targets inside Russia. All this comes at a key moment in the conflict, one highlighted by Mr. Lammy when he spoke to the BBC. The Foreign Secretary refused to discuss what he called operational issues about missile use, but said the fact that Iran was now giving Russia missiles had changed the whole debate.
What the ballistic missiles allow is for Russia to have further penetration into Ukraine and to use long-range missiles, deploy those long-range missiles as well in a more deliberate pattern into mainland Ukraine. That is very dangerous, it's very worrying, and of course we will do all we can to ensure that Ukraine win.
So what chance is there of restrictions on missile use being loosened by the US, Britain or other allies? And if they were, what sort of missiles are we talking about? Well, the military analyst Marina Myron is a researcher at King's College London's War Studies Department and joins me. Marina, good evening.
Good evening.
The focus here is on Storm Shadow missiles. Tell us what they can do and why they might make a difference here.
Well, firstly, what we have to understand is that Storm Shadow missiles have a range of 150 miles. However, these missiles require aircraft to be fired, so they are air-to-surface missiles, and they have also the ability to evade air defenses due to their low-altitude flights. And also, they have a double explosive capacity for hardened targets. So the missile penetrates a target and then it explodes again in order to make sure that the target is effectively destroyed. And of course, Ukraine wants to use them on Russian territory. However, the problem is, on the one hand, the number of missiles that Ukraine has at its disposal. And the second problem is that Ukraine doesn't have air superiority in order to deliver them. So essentially falling victim to Russian ground-based air defenses.
How much would the Russians fear them, though, if they were used?
Well, we have to understand that these missiles they have a triple navigation system, and one of the navigation systems is a GPS. And the Russians have already seen these missiles used in Crimea, so they had enough time to adapt their air defenses and their electronic warfare jammers in order to defend themselves against these missiles. Also, as has been confirmed by the U.S., they moved all the critical targets away from the potential range if the decision is taken to allow Ukraine such deep strikes.
This would be an escalation, clearly, if it were permitted. It does seem as if this conflict, step by step, moves ever further forward in the direction of something more serious, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does. And a lot of politicians in the West are fearing a nuclear escalation on part of Russia. How probable that is difficult to tell whether Putin would actually cross the threshold of using a tactical nuclear weapon. I think that the Russian response could potentially be in a completely different domain rather than the military domain. And this involves, as we've heard before, cooperation with countries like Iran and North Korea, sharing military technologies and know-how, which would pose even a greater long-term threat to international security.
Thank you very much, Marina Myron. Well, earlier I spoke to the former Conservative MP, Grant Shapps, who was Defence Secretary until the election in July. I began by asking him about whether the current Labour government should allow Ukraine to use British-supplied long-range missiles against targets inside Russia.
I think it's very important that this is something that happens, because Putin, time and again, has been shown as somebody who, you know, says if you do this thing, all hell will break loose. In reality, of course, we've seen throughout this war, Western equipment supplied, it being used in a variety of different ways, including in Crimea. And each time it's a false line.
The Americans, of course, have also so far resisted calls for allowing Ukraine to use Storm Shadow missiles against Russian targets on Russian territory. So they are weighing this up in the same way that the British government has been doing so. So why do you think this is the moment for both to reconsider that?
Britain has a unique leading role in the way that the whole conflict in Ukraine has played out. We've always been the first to provide NLAW anti-tank missiles, the first to provide training for pilots. In other words, our role is to lead on this and encourage our friends and neighbours to join in. We are the biggest military force in NATO in Europe, but also I think the historic responsibility of understanding that when things go wrong like this in Europe, there is no chance that Putin would stop with Ukraine. I mean, none had we not stepped up, particularly I think at the time, Boris Johnson, my predecessor as well, Ben Wallace, myself as Defence Secretary, and I hope now the new Defence Secretary and Prime Minister. But it is important to understand that Ukraine is still largely free today because that action was taken by Britain. And it's not me saying this. This is what President Zelensky says to me whenever I speak to him.
And you presumably have no doubts that Britain continues in exactly that same place, despite the fact that we now have a different government.
I think the government's heart is in the right place. I think they want to do the right thing. There is a difference between willing it to happen, wanting it to happen, and making it happen. And that difference is, if you like, the sort of that's the thing I'm trying to encourage this new government to bridge.
If permission is allowed for the use of long-range British missiles against targets inside Russia, should there be a stipulation that says they can only be military targets?
Yes, because that's the law. And that is how Britain always behaves in these situations.
I mean, I ask that because there was a drone attack on Moscow yesterday, which killed at least one civilian. Now, clearly that had nothing to do with the British government. But if that starts to happen, is that not potentially a problem, particularly as you have just cited the law and how it stands on this?
When you're at war, sadly, you can get collateral damage. The difference is if you deliberately target civilians rather than those civilians being an inadvertent outcome of a military prosecuted target. And there is no doubt whatsoever that President Putin regularly and routinely not only prosecutes civilian targets, but he actually doesn't even care about the number of the lives that are lost on the Russian side. And so we've now seen way over 500,000 Russian soldiers killed in this pointless conflict.
Is there not, though, a concern in your mind that Russia would go even beyond what you have just described in response to this kind of change? They've said today at the Kremlin that Russia would roll out what they call an appropriate response if the US allowed Ukraine to strike deep inside Russia, the implication being if anybody allowed Ukraine to strike deep inside Russia with Western weapons. What's your concern, if any, about what Russia would do in response?
You must think these things through. You must be concerned, and I lay awake at night and worried about the balance of these decisions, of course, in taking them. However, if we took that approach and we literally took what Putin says at face value, we never would have had the bravery to do the things that we have done to lead the world in the UK in helping Ukraine stand against his despotic attacks.
Do you not, though, have to recognise the possibility that a few months from now, this will be regarded as an escalation with all the possible consequences therein? But in 3 months from now, for sake of argument, it doesn't dramatically change what's happening on the ground. Ukraine are not regaining territory that they have lost. And then you're sitting there asking, well, now what do we do?
I just don't accept that there's a safe amount of land that you can accept Putin deciding should be his own. Let's be honest, that's what happened in 2014 when he walked into Crimea. And the world made a bit of a noise about it, but it just didn't bother to really impose any substantial sanctions. And that led to the next thing. And the next thing, of course, is this full-scale invasion. When you allow these things to go on, actually, I go back further even to Assad in 2013 and what happened then. You can trace what happens every time you turn a blind eye to this kind of aggression by dictators on democracies. And every time you do that, you live to regret it. And that's certainly been the lesson of Crimea.
A word about the American position. Obviously, Anthony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, is there with David Lammy at the moment. It might not be Anthony Blinken after November. It might be a Donald Trump appointee if he wins the presidential election. And he is on the record as recently as last night saying that he would solve this. He'd get everybody sitting around the table. It wouldn't have started if he'd been in power. And when asked if he wanted Ukraine to win the war, he didn't categorically say yes. How much of that, if any, worries you?
Well, it all very much worries me. And it is one of the reasons, and this is somewhere where I actually do agree with Trump, Europe does need to step up. It is our continent that this is happening on. And that does mean that we need to pay 2.5%, as we said. However, I completely disagree with Trump's perspective when he says things like, it would all be over in 24 hours, or let's all just sit down and negotiate an outcome. And at what point is it okay just to negotiate the outcome? If this was Kent that had been invaded, would Brits be saying, well, come on, it's about time we did a deal with the invader? I don't think so.
Former Defence Secretary Grant Shapps. Now, take a walk in central London and it won't be long before you spot a blue commemorative plaque on the wall of a building marking a place where a famous figure once lived. Now, these plaques date back to the second half of the 19th century when the poet Lord Byron was honoured at his house and birthplace near Cavendish Square, just a stone's throw from Broadcasting House. Now, when that property was demolished, the plaque was lost, and that's true of many others. As many as 50 have been categorised as missing by English Heritage, and now they're hoping for help from the public to find them. Well, earlier in search of blue plaques, I went to another significant spot in the West End. I'm standing in Park Crescent, which is an impressive sweep of pillared properties very close to the entrance to Regent's Park, right in the middle of central London. And I'm specifically standing outside number 12 Park Crescent. Now, you look at these buildings and you think they might date back several hundred years. The Crescent was actually rebuilt to look like the original in 1960 after war damage. And there was a plaque on this building remembering the surgeon Joseph Lister. Well, after war damage and a new plaque was commissioned, the original rectangular bronze tablet turned up, having gone missing, after an appeal in The Lancet. It was put back in 1966. It stayed there until 2017, and then it disappeared. And as things stand, it has yet to be found. Well, I've walked no more than 10 minutes away, so I'm still very much in the West End of London. Specifically, I've come to the Fitzrovia area, which is predominantly residential. And as I come along this particular street, which is Maple Street, I've got quite tall houses dating back probably about 100 years, maybe more, to one side, and high up to my right, the BT Tower. But I've come here for one particular reason, to speak to Howard Spencer of English Heritage.
We're standing right by a new plaque, a new English Heritage blue plaque to Joseph Lister, pioneer of antiseptic surgery. It's just gone in. The story is that he had one before, but it's disappeared twice, and the second time we think it's gone for good, which is why we've put this new one in at this new address.
And this plaque tells us that he lived here as a student, so as a very young man.
That's right. He lived here from about 1844 to 47. He lived here with a flatmate called Edward Palmer, and we know this from some of his letters that he sent to his mother in 1844. He clearly found it quite tiresome to be asked to write home regularly. He was clearly expected to do so once a week, even though home was only in Upton, as in West Ham.
Now, we're not here to talk just about this blue plaque, but about blue plaques more generally, and the fact that quite a lot have gone missing, haven't they?
Over the years, there has been a sort of an attrition rate. They do go missing when buildings usually get demolished. I should say that this is fairly historical. Most of them went some time ago. And we're really just taking this opportunity of putting this new plaque up to Lister to shake the tree a bit and ask if anyone knows of the whereabouts of any of the old, mostly London County Council plaques that have disappeared over the years.
Are there any particular names that you're looking out for on them?
I think we're just interested in finding out if there is anything out there. I mean, I suspect, to be honest, that most of them just wind up in the foundations of replacement buildings. That's what's happened. But periodically, we know that they do reappear. So it would be nice if any did.
I mean, I guess that's the point, isn't it? If there's a redevelopment and a building has a plaque on it, those doing the redeveloping don't necessarily take a great deal of care over it, do they?
Often they do. They do return them to us. I mean, there was a fairly recent years that the one Air Chief Marshal Dowding, which was down in Wimbledon, that house was redeveloped and that came back to us, and it's now at the National Arboretum in Staffordshire on show. So that's a good example of people doing what we ask them to, which is basically to send them back to us, and we will hopefully find a new home for them one way or the other, preferably on another London building.
How much do people, not just people living in London, but people visiting London, sometimes from abroad, how much do they value these plaques?
That's a bit hard for me to say, really. I'm possibly not the person to judge, because I'm rather close to it. But I like to think they do. I mean, certainly I've been standing here for a while watching people going past, and a lot of heads have turned, because this is a new plaque. People aren't accustomed to seeing it here. I think that they are very popular additions to the streetscape. And, of course, they do mark this important link between building and person.
Howard Spencer of English Heritage. Before we go, a quick look at tomorrow's front pages, most of them leading on our top story. The Guardian's headline is "Thousands Dying Due to NHS Delays, Inquiry Finds." And the Daily Mail front page is also focusing on that story, reading "NHS Must Reform or Die," says Prime Minister. And it says that Sir Keir Starmer has vowed its biggest overhaul ever. And that is The World Tonight. This is Julian Warwicker for now from me and everyone on the programme. Have a very good Wednesday night.
Studio direction on The World Tonight this evening was by Charlotte Hadroy-Tuzimska, and the editor was Jack Hunter.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.